does beauty have to do with sports, or advanced technology, or the economy? I am Isabella Rossellini, and in each episode of This Is Not a Beauty Podcast, I uncover stories that explain beauty's fascinating and often hidden role in modern life. Listen to This Is Not a Beauty Podcast now on your favorite podcast platform. Brought to you by L'Oréal Group.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your high-level thinker fest of music, news, and criticism, but also this week, reality TV news and criticism. I'm John Garamonica.
I'm Joe Coscarelli, reporter at the New York Times. Oh, we're not doing titles anymore?
Everyone just knows. They've made it this far. If you are choosing to listen to Popcast during a historic election week in America, you know who we are.
Yeah, and we're here to soothe your brains.
We are. So very pointedly, Joe and I last week were like, what are we going to do? This is we don't know what's going to happen, obviously. It's before the election. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the week's going to be like. And we were like, we want to do something that if you need a little bit of an escape, you're probably going to need a little bit of an escape. If you've come to us, you've come to us for a reason. And that is to hear me and Joe speak about something a tiny bit frothy that we love, which is reality television. Later, we will be joined by Karen Gans, who also loves something frothy. And we're going to talk about another thing. But we're going to start by talking about Love is Blind, which just concluded season 7. Later, when Karen shows up, we're going to talk about the current season of Survivor, Nerds First Nerds. Joe, Love is Blind season 7. I just watched, finally, the reunion episode earlier today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, same.
Garrett, where did Garrett procure that sport coat, do you think?
I thought you would know.
No. See, this is the thing. Like, everybody's like, oh, Garrett's in his glow-up era. Garrett's in his fashion era. And I'm quite sure that is a tapestry that has been remade as a sport coat. Like, that right. That maybe came from Garrett's grandma's house. Like, I don't really know where that came from. Look, he was wearing motorcycle boots of a sort. He did appear to have a wide leg trouser. He was unbuttoned to the third button. Like, I understand he's trying something. His hair, he did have long hair, but man, that sport coat, they auctioned that off for charity. Please. I wish to not see that again.
Here's what I'll say about Garrett's glow up, which I think applies to the whole season and the whole conversation we're about to have, is the most important thing to remember about season 7 of Love is Blind on Netflix is that it's set in Washington, D.C.
Big facts.
And the D.C.-ness is all over the fashion, the politics, the personalities.
Oh, man.
The jobs. I mean, the job descriptions are incredible.
Yeah. So Garrett.
Nuclear officer.
Great. Garrett and Taylor. Taylor is a clean energy policy lobbyist, maybe, or something, or researcher, yep, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. Also, Taylor showing up to the reunion show with a gold breastplate that maybe.
Yeah, wearing Zendaya's leftovers.
Well, I mean, I did want to say, they didn't speak about this. They did talk about Garrett's glow up. They did not talk about Taylor's outfit. If that was, I don't know, Schiaparelli, for example. First of all, shout out my guy, Dan Roseberry. But if that was Schiaparelli, phenomenal. Happy to see it. If it was Sheehan, concerning. However, that said, look, very happy to see Garrett and Taylor holding it down for a year. Also, Ashley and Tyler successfully made it.
Yeah. So we're going backwards from the reunion.
Yes. So successfully, 1 year of marriage, bless them. But yes, the DC-ness of this season. I mean, okay, this reminds me a little bit. Did you ever watch Married at First Sight?
No.
Never. Not even the early seasons.
No.
Okay. So if I'm remembering correctly, and someone feel free to email me if I'm not right, but I'm pretty sure that this is what happened. In the earliest seasons of Married at First Sight, one of the signature problems they had was that they did not filter for region. So you could plausibly end up married to someone who lived 1,000 miles away, and then you had to sort of like figure out what to do. So then in later seasons, they started filtering for region. But then what happened is the season got incredibly regionally specific, like the North Carolina-ness of a season, the Atlanta-ness. You really did see local color for good and for bad. Obviously, with Love is Blind, they factor that in right at the top, and you end up with DC, which is notionally a metropole, but genuinely is not. And so you end up with people with unusual jobs, a sort of quasi transience. It's like we're in the big city, but we are quasi transient in the big city because very few people are actually from DC.
Yeah, there's lots of sort of metro area, but also tri-state area.
Yeah, like DMV.
Fredericksburg. Yeah, there's Baltimore. There's DC proper. There's a lot of, suburbs, exurbs, etc.
How did you feel about the overall quality of the connections on this season of Love is Blind?
I got to be honest with you. I was kind of blown away by them. And by the maturity of some of these relationships and the couples, even the ones that didn't work out.
Yes.
I thought this seemed like the sanest season of the show that I've seen. I thought, you know, I do think we could ask the headline question, like, are men okay? Which I think like carries across a lot of culture and reality television. I think are men okay stands. But overall, I thought communication was really high level from a lot of these people, even the people like we'll get to Leo, but like Leo is a pretty good communicator for being somebody who is also lacking in some self-awareness. Steven is a pretty good communicator, even though he has a lot of other issues that he needs to work through. I could just start with Tyler and Ashley, who among the best reality TV couples that I've ever seen.
I know this is going to sound glib. I don't mean it glibly, like actual couple goals. The chemistry is real. Like, and it's not because they're like living some like high unreachable fantasy. It's because they appear to be capable of looking at each other in the eye and telling each other what they feel, even when it's difficult, and then getting through it.
Yes. And we're in a period of romance movies, of sexy thrillers coming back, rom-coms maybe they're trying to bring back. To me, the romance film of the year is the reveal between Tyler and Ashley from season 7 of Love is Blind. Like
they want to eat each other up.
The sparks coming off of the two of them was legitimately moving and, dare I say, sexy.
It was what Clay and AD thought they were.
Yes.
Seriously. Like that never was that more clear than on the reunion when AD showed up. And I thought was kind of like a little basic, like kind of like, I'm living my best life. Like, you know, it's like, no, like I bet AD is looking at Ashley and Tyler and being like, damn, like that.
I want that. Yeah.
That's what or even better, I truly thought that that's what this was. And it wasn't that.
Right. And you mentioned Taylor and Garrett, the only other couple. I mean, even the fact that only two couples made it to the altar and both of them seemed like couples that could work off of reality television. Like they didn't seem like they were in love for TV or getting like I wasn't watching through my fingers. I was like, oh, these people like, huh, this experiment, as they like to refer to Love is Blind as opposed to a reality show, like it can work. And I'm not saying these people are going to be married forever, but I'm like, Taylor and Garrett, they used the pods to their advantage, and Tyler and Ashley did the same thing, and I had no real doubts about either of them as they got married, even though they'd only known each other for 3 weeks or whatever it was. I don't know. Do you agree?
Yeah. So to me, and it's tough to know if this is in direct response to some of the legal challenges that Love and Blind has had over the last couple of years about like inhumane working conditions, producers like sort of knowing that people were ill-suited to each other or perhaps had secrets in their past and not being transparent about them. I don't know.
Good stories about this by our colleague Julia Jacobs.
Yes.
Good feature in the New Yorker by Emily Nussbaum about Love is Blind behind the scenes. Quite juicy stuff, really. So check those out if you care about this show and its ethics at all.
And it made me wonder if, in the wake of those legal concerns, if they double down in the quality of the casting. If they said, you know, they're like, here's where we fell short, even if they're not admitting in any legal sense that they fell short. But where they fell short is they didn't X people out who had things that are potentially disqualifying. They encouraged people to stay together who actually probably should have split up. They essentially pushed people to walk down the aisle to the altar, knowing that they were going to, one or more was going to say no. And I thought it was notable that actually seven couples got engaged this season, or seven couples that we know about got engaged, because sometimes there have been couples that got engaged that they don't use storylines on. Seven couples got engaged. Two of them that made it to the altar were basically 100% yeses. And everybody else had the good sense to pull the ripcord. And I, you know a little bit about how reality television works. Like, I don't think like Ramses just decided on a Monday morning, I'm done. I'm sure he talked to the producer and said, I think I'm done. And the producer, rather than saying, hey, just stick it out, just make it to the aisle, it's great, you guys, maybe you'll feel differently, I've got to assume that the production choices were more like, hey, okay, that's unfortunate, but let's just knock it out on camera and everybody can go back to their lives. That makes me think that there was a renewed commitment to ethics in the casting and production. Again, it's speculation, but that was my main takeaway, is that this season felt more mature, more responsible. And to your point, the men in particular, frankly, more than the women, the men in particular were incredibly articulate and encouraging with their feelings and with their vulnerabilities, even when
I'm not going to say they were more so than the women, but relatively to past seasons of Love is Blind, I see where you're coming from.
I think more so than the women. You think about obviously the way that Hannah was speaking to Nick, like just like really, really difficult. Like even
she
the
was
kind of like,
but she was correct almost all the time.
but still, like that's not how I wish to be spoken to in a relationship.
I mean, I thought Marissa and the Rams relationship, Ramses relationship was quite intense. Touch with herself and her feelings. I thought Monica had some tough moments, but again, I think she, just like Hannah, like the reason they were acting up and because they knew something was wrong and they were correct that they should not be with that person. But to your point about this season being a bit more ethical, again, mm-hmm. relatively, I think.
And again, we don't know what we didn't see. There may have been things we didn't see. We may hear things. We really know what we see.
But even the fact that they didn't let Brittany and Leo go to Cabo, they were just like, nah, like you're cut, basically. And you heard them talk about it on the reunion where they said like the producers were really looking for people who they believed were going to make it. And
yeah.
If you saw the reveal between Brittany and Leo, you knew like that was not going to last. But maybe even the evening.
Okay.
But if they just wanted the car crash, they would have just sent them to Cabo no matter what.
Okay. To be fair, I have a alternate perspective on Brittany and Leo, which is if the show had invested in them, they would have figured out how to make it sort of work, because ultimately Leo is the type of person structurally that Brittany was looking for, and
rich.
Leo, yes, rich and kind of like, you can just do you, like I'm just going to do this and you can do you. That's essentially what she said she was looking for. Leo, clearly, if you're choosing between Brittany and Hannah, like clearly you have no perspective whatsoever on what you need in life. You clearly don't know anything about yourself or your own needs. But I think he looked at her and said, this is a beautiful woman. I would love to travel and take this person around the world. And he would have brain melted his way to making it work. I understand that there was not an instant spark between the two of them, but I actually perversely think that that relationship truly had more legs than, say, Tim and Hannah, is it? Tim, who never seemed genuinely connected in any real way. They were two people who, like, were Tim and verbal Alex. About yeah. Tim and Alex, sorry, two people who were verbal about their own kind of like needs and the dysfunction of those needs without ever fully like making accommodations for the other person's dysfunction needs.
Yeah, well, they were the dud couple of the season until it detonated at the reunion, because obviously their big fight happened off camera.
And they didn't want to recreate it. Like
they didn't want to recreate it. But I thought their back and forth was quite heated at the reunion in a way that made me think they did have real feelings for each other, at least at some point. I see what you're saying about Brittany and Leo on paper. Yes, what they said they wanted. But again, like if they could have just found what they thought they needed on paper, like they wouldn't be on Love is Blind in the first place. So I just think there was no chance. I mean, and you see it now, like they could have figured it out afterwards and they're like, we're friends, but
I'm just saying I wouldn't be surprised to see like a Love is Blind season 12 reunion and they bring Brittany and Leo back and they figure it out and I'm just saying I wouldn't be shocked.
You're either a romantic or, as Hannah wrote on her list, delusional.
I am delulu. Okay. Also, I don't have any expertise in fine wristwear. I don't even know if it's a good Rolex. Just candidly, Mike Nouveau, if you're listening, take a look at Leo's Rolex. I can't tell. Is it a $4,000 one or is it a $40,000 one? I just don't know. So, but
surely Bryn has the answer on Dime Piece. Yeah, already. We gotta check the account.
That's true. We should have Googled. There was a lot of talk about the Rolex, but I do think, so I felt this with Leo and Brittany. I felt this with Taylor and Garrett. I did feel this a little bit with Ashley and Tyler. As far as the ethics of the casting, in some prior seasons, I haven't necessarily felt that that the producers and casters in their mind were like, person one should go with person seven, woman two should go with man four. This season, I absolutely think they were like, I think Taylor and Garrett are a thing. Like, I think Leo and Brittany are a thing. And they're just steering people in that direction. That's how it felt to me.
I'm Shane Goldmacher. I'm a national political correspondent for the New York Times, covering the 2024 election. I have off and on for years covered the role of money in politics, and that means sifting through tens of thousands of line items in campaign reports, looking at who's getting paid, how much they're getting paid, who's donating to these campaigns, who's reserved the most ads on Google, who's this billionaire changing the shape of the race with a single check. Look, the campaign spin, the strategists tell you one thing, the numbers don't really lie, and those numbers help us ask the right questions. That's what's so special about the New York Times. We get to tap the collective knowledge and wisdom of my colleagues who have expertise in every nook and cranny of this country and this campaign trail to tell you the full story of what's happening in these critical moments in the last few weeks of the election. If this kind of coverage is important to you, you can support it by subscribing to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
There were a couple people like Leo, the art dealer with the Rolex, who were deciding between two extremely different people. When you're thinking of like Marissa and Ramses, who she ends up with, and she was with the Bowden guy, Steven had another connection in the pod. I'm blanking. Regardless, I think it still felt self-driven to me. It just felt like there were cleaner matches. But the maturity of the season overall, and I do think this continues to be blanketed by the DC-ness of it all, but it wasn't just in the emotional connections, but it was also in like the things we got to see them talk about. Like they talked about, I'll just run through it, like Palestine, Trump, contraception, Mormonism, the military, the morality of the military.
90% like, of this is Ramses really? And Marissa, just for the record, though. Literally 90%.
That's true. Ashley and Tyler, who we talked about before, like making it through a really intense thing, which is that he didn't tell her that he had three children with a friend, seemingly as some sort of a sperm donor, although there's been disputes about whether all of them were donated children, and he sort of addressed it on the reunion, but it happened very quickly. Or even the sexuality that Steven was discussing at first, seemingly jokingly, and then becomes less funny as the show goes on, and he gets in trouble for sexting with a stranger. But, you know, him talking about the fame of the show and sort of reality TV groupies, like, I thought there was like a lot of third rail.
Also, Steven and his that and usually his uncovered from. Ancestry. Like, basically thought he was Steven Italian and it turned out 10% yeah. Ghanaian. And then,
which I think actually got him engaged on the show. That's true. Like, she kept bringing it up as the thing that like his passion for learning about his African heritage really moved her.
Sidebar, have you ever done a sleep study?
No, but I would love to do a sleep study. I've done a sleep honestly. Study.
I do not remember being allowed that degree of access to my phone. I just don't.
Also, don't you think getting worked up affected the sleep study for him? Like, don't you think the results are null and void if you're sexting?
If you are a sleep doctor, please, I would like to have like some medical weighing in about like whether you should be sexting during a sleep study. I truly, honestly, though, when he had that excuse and was like, I didn't come home because I had a sleep study. First of all, it seemed obvious he was lying, but apparently not. Or he did the most crazy Amazon.com Halloween costume ever to get a photo of himself in a bed looking like he was in a sleep study. I truly thought there was no way. But also, if you are doing a sleep study, he didn't tell her. He didn't tell her the night before.
No. She did. She seemed to know that it was on the schedule. I read an interview with her in Vulture where she seemed to know that he had this sleep study on the schedule for a long time.
I just feel like if I would have a sleep study like this week, for example, I would tell multiple people. Like, I would tell you. I'm not engaged to you. Right. I would tell you, though. I would tell Karen. Like, I would just let people know. And I just, like, I didn't feel like he was, like, maybe he was forthcoming. It didn't really, the vibe was not forthcoming.
Something deeply, deeply broken about the way Steven was portrayed and portrayed himself on this show. I mean, just the fact that he was very adamant, A, about talking about the possibility of all of this in the lead up, talking about his past getting caught for DMing girls, and then leaving his phone on the counter with no password when he had just been sexting with a stranger. It was just like, it's all very, very much, you know, begging to be caught vibes. That was the darkest plot line for me.
Maybe that's his kink.
Yeah, maybe that's the fetish he was dancing around.
We do not kink shame on podcasts, but maybe that's his kink.
No.
Not whatever he was texting about.
Monica's kink is definitely karma, though. Now moving forward. Okay, wait. I wanna zoom in on two of these couples that we've only glossed on, but you can decide which one we're gonna do first, and that's Marissa and Ramses, and obviously Nick and Hannah.
Genuinely, I find Nick and Hannah's tragic on so many levels. So let's do Marissa and Ramses, because I feel like there's actual meat on the bone there. Nick and Hannah are two immature people. No matter, I don't care if Hannah like left home at 18 and like runs her own household, like they are emotionally immature. To me, that would have been like, if the producers were like, one couple doesn't go to Cabo, Nick and Hannah. To me, Nick and Hannah all day. So let's talk about Marissa and Ramses, which is a fascinating relationship. So Marissa is a former naval officer or soldier of some kind. She's in the Navy. Now is a civilian, but extremely pro-military. And pro-military, I didn't get the sense in the kind of like, I wish to be an imperialist kind of way, but more in a, I see this as a group of essentially like-minded and similarly culturally and financially situated people all working together for common goal.
Though I did get some real whiplash from her monologue about the military. Like, you're saying she's extremely pro-military, but she had that whole thing about having her finger on the button to launch a missile, to kill people, and like having to, what would it be like to have to look somebody in the eye?
Did she actually say that she had her finger on the button, or was she saying that as a hypothetical? I found that conversation.
That's what I'm saying. That entire monologue was head spinning, and I thought she was saying that she was anti-military, but then she landed in the place of like, but I don't regret it and I might do it again.
I think she was saying she's anti-death, maybe, but pro-military.
Right, which is a tough, I Team Ramses in that's a tough needle to thread.
Yeah. Yes. That is that's the thread that you have to thread it as tightly as one of his little braids.
Yes.
I thought it was fascinating that Ramses, a person who seems to have genuine anti-imperialist views, like a person who is skeptical of American power on the global sphere, would knowingly choose to date a person who comes as a product of not just in the military, but I think she said was a military household. Maybe
yes,
grew up
yes.
in the military as well. This seems to me an incredibly short-sighted choice on his part. And so for him to say, actually, the thing that I didn't like about Marissa and the reason I chose to end our engagement is she had too much energy. How did we even get to the too much energy point? Isn't that what he said?
I think he meant too much bad energy. I don't think he meant like she was hyper. I think he meant she was.
I think he meant
she was stressy. He said our energies don't match. They don't align. I don't want her energy in my life.
Or was he saying that she has imperialist energy and he has anti-imperialist energy? Well,
going back to the pods, I mean, this is another couple where like the chemistry was real and only intensified when they saw each other. And I thought like they overlooked some biographical and life goal disconnect because they had a lot going on. Yeah, they had a lot going on emotionally and physically, I think.
But I also think Ramses was probably just wild flirty with everybody. Like this is another thing is they did not show, like the producers, outside of the Leo situation and the Marissa situation, where they didn't show people essentially spitting game to other people. But like you didn't really see, like I kind of got the sense that like Ramses was probably a bit of a flirt and like Marissa seemed to be in a place in her life where she wanted to be flirted with. But I was very, very surprised that he would make a choice to partner with a person who knowingly or not and intentionally or not embodied a value system that clearly has nothing to do with his personal values. And it made me wonder, given the fact that he was divorced and feels like he was kind of like maybe like a dog. I can't really tell, but maybe he was a dog in a previous relationship. Some guilt there.
Yeah, for sure.
He is carrying something. Yeah. It made me wonder if someone who, and I don't mean Marissa is square in like a dull sense, but someone who comes from a more formal, traditional, structured family, maybe he thought that's a person that makes sense for me so that I don't do whatever I did last time. Because once I'm faced with a person who was in the military and doesn't take mess and doesn't take guff, like maybe he thought that was an opportunity for him to kind of like step up into his next chapter.
I think she was really bristling up against what kind of person she had been and what kind of person she wanted to become. And I think she saw
she's definitely Ramses in transition
as a path to that. You said traditional family structure. I don't know that I would call Marissa's siblings and mother a traditional family structure.
I hear that. Okay, fair. Taken.
But I do think, you know, hearing her talk about her Mormonism and whether faith would play a role in their marriage and all of that, like I do think she was real. There was a real tug within her, which I thought made her an extremely compelling character. And her pain when they broke up, I thought was really raw.
So raw.
But her mom sort of cutting the tension by being like, love is not forever. Like, I don't believe in any of this.
Incredible.
Like, just like sort of pulling the rug out from the whole concept of the show was again, something that I think elevated the season beyond most dating reality television.
One thing that I was struck by with her mother, again, number one, that the producers chose to weave that reluctance into the show, like her reluctance, but also I think what the mom said is totally fair. You know what? You reach a certain age and maybe the person who you partner with, that may not be your partner for the rest of your life. And maybe the reason that you think that is because you have been let down multiple times before. And shows like Love is Blind are premised upon no matter what you've been through before, it probably wasn't good, but we're going to give you a fresh start to feel the other way, to feel that everything is possible. And I truly think most people in the world are like the mom. Most people in the world are like the mom and like, hey, maybe this is going to work. Maybe it's not going to work. And even if it works, might not work forever. And that energy, first of all, I'd love to see the mom do a some other reality show.
Oh, yeah. She should be the Golden Bachelorette.
Yeah, Golden Bachelorette or Survivor. We're going to talk about Survivor. Maybe put her on Survivor. Talk about
she could win Survivor.
Chopping next.
For sure.
Absolutely. So truly a star is born with Marissa's mother. But I really was grateful for that perspective because I do think that that perspective both is true to a lot of people's personal feelings. And it also, it does undercut a little bit of the dream of the show, which is fair. Because like we're so deep into the reality dating show era that like you don't watch it to see people fall in love. You watch it in essence to see the ways in which they're going to fail each other. And Marissa's right. mom was like, that's about to happen.
Yeah, let me narrate that for y'all.
What did you make what did you make of Ramses' outfit at the reunion?
I mean, just as Marissa's mom said, I'm not messing with your style in general. So
I haven't looked at his IG. I haven't Googled him. I don't know what does he do for work?
I don't quite understand what kind of guy he is, period.
Okay, so I don't know what he does for work. I don't know where he hangs out. I don't know what his crew's like. I don't know what his team's like. I don't know if he's like the alpha in the crew or like the seventh guy in the crew. I don't really know. What I do know is that I do not know any crews of any people, cool or uncool, that are dressing like that today in 2024. Again,
Washington, D.C.
But he might be the absolute, like, he might be the sickest guy in Fredericksburg. I have no idea. It could be, but I just very simply don't know. And I admire the off-brand references. I admire that he's coming out with the full Curtis Blow 1981. Like, there's something in that man that is serious, but it is not his commitment to love.
The cheekbones are serious.
Out of control.
He's got serious face.
Great structure. Great structure. Unbelievable. Do you think that Love is Blind, I was really concerned I was really concerned, obviously, after all the legal troubles, I was really concerned that this would be, in essence, the undoing of the show on a number of levels. One, that they would be overcorrecting for it in some bad way. But two, that good, sellable, dateable people would no longer wish to participate. But that does not appear to have happened.
On screen, it feels like they righted the ship. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I don't know how shady the show is or isn't. Right. That's not any reporting that I've done. But I think it definitely felt like a stabilizing season for the brand.
And again, the fact that the couples that made it to the altar made it at 100%, that I think is the show signaling to an audience, this is what we're trying to be about. Yes, we have couples that fight. Yes, we have couples that break up, but we also have real conversations that lead to breakups. But we're going to thank you at the end of the season. The way we're going to repay you for watching the whole thing is by giving you the fantasy, or at least giving everybody but Marissa's mom the fantasy.
And we're not just here to humiliate people, except for Nick.
Okay, you want to do Nick and Hannah real fast? Because, like, honest, first of all, you want to talk about glow ups or glow something. Also, everybody, because it's so DC, especially this year, but just in general, like, people come to the reunions looking crazy. The changes.
Also, the year between.
But the changes in aesthetics, in bodies, in.
Yes. Feet,
like, there's a lot of changes. And Hannah.
Bodies are changing quicker than ever.
Yes.
Styles are changing quite quickly. People get on TV and they fix their teeth. You know, like, there's a lot going on there. And Hannah was open throughout the show that she'd had ups and downs. You know, losing 45 pounds was a big part of her character in the pods.
Yep.
The sort of insecurity between I'm a hot girl or I'm going to be disappointing to them. You could tell that she was living with one foot in each of those worlds, which I thought made her very compelling. Look, she was the main character of the season, I think, ultimately.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that meant that meant that that Nick had to be dragged along for the ride.
Notably, did not glow up at all for the reunion. Had a whole year, had a whole year to grow his beard, even as long as yours is right now, which is not that, like, it's a little longer than mine. And somehow for a year, couldn't figure out that actually he should grow his beard in a tiny bit. Couldn't figure it out.
Can we just talk about him quoting the Kim Kardashian sample at the beginning of Drake's Search and Rescue?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't come this far just to come this far. We're going to go out from this segment with that as soon as we finish up Nick and Hannah.
I honestly, that's my email signature. That's like literally every time I'm trying to get something from somebody, I just want y'all to know I didn't come this far just to come this far.
But that guy gives Drake fans a bad name. but is also maybe more representative than either of us would like to admit.
He might even listen to podcasts, you know,
right?
Nick, if you're listening.
I don't know if he's gotten to that level yet, but I do think, like, watching them compared to the maturity of the two couples that got married on the show, like, it was like you were watching a different show when it would cut to them. Yeah. You know, the scene of them, of him trying to boil pasta, trying to say bucatini, all of that. It felt like watching the real world versus watching like a grown and sexy romance on the other side, the Tyler and the Ashley stuff.
It's funny you say that Hannah is the main character of the season, but because did you not find her grating and fearsome and not in a good way?
I found her surprising at every turn. I did not understand that she was going to be super type A when she was in the pods. Like, I didn't know she was going to be, you know, the vacuuming every day. I thought the gay brother who came over for dinner was a twist. And then they topped that twist with the sort of like super white bread down the middle rest of her family. I was on my toes with her throughout. And I think she was hard to put in a box. You saw and you heard her in the first couple episodes and you thought she was one thing. And then they just kept piling onto that. And I thought she was, quite a complex person working her way to maturity. And I liked watching the journey. I wasn't turned off by her as a reality television character. You just thought she was, because I even when they were talking on the reunion of, oh, she's getting such a hard time, she was so mean to him, blah blah blah, like I could see how that would be a takeaway from the season, but I didn't feel that. You did?
Yeah, I thought she was an incredibly difficult and ultimately one note character as the season got deeper and deeper, because her disappointment with Nick, which I think is a mask for her disappointment in herself for having made that choice or been allowed to make that choice or whatever, became the dominant part of her narrative. And I did not find it intellectually or emotionally compelling, kind of as like pure thought. And I didn't find it televisually compelling, because it really, like, look, I'm not saying Nick showed up and was like a great, perfect person, but I do think that it did feel abusive. And even there's this hilarious moment in the reunion where Marissa
abusive.
Look, this man telling him, I made you the man that you are. I made you everything that you are.
This
everything
man
you
cannot are is because boil of me. Water, feed a cat.
I'm not saying that
he doesn't.
Is there not a better way to communicate that?
He is not sexually mature. He is not. He lives with his parents.
Like, I mean, again, I'm not saying that he's,
I'm more mad at him above, than Hannah
he's
has
not
ever
above
been.
Rebuke. Okay, I'm not saying he's beyond rebuke. What I am saying is that at the reunion, when Marissa was like, this is my best friend and I'm riding for her, and yeah, you're mean to me too.
Right. Yes.
I'm like, well, there it is. Yeah. We've just learned quite a bit about both Hannah and Marissa. I want to conclude this half of the conversation this week with a sliding doors experiment, which is, what if Leo had chosen Hannah or Hannah had chosen Leo?
I spent a lot of time trying
to figure out what Leo thought he saw in Hannah. And maybe that type A-ness of how she like moved through the world is like, I like emancipated or whatever at 18 and I built my own life. Maybe he's responding to that, but that wasn't clear on the show. What do you think happens if the sliding doors open and they look at each other?
I just think he's never talked to a woman with a Southern accent before. I gotta be honest.
And he was like, this must be the most iconic woman ever because she has an accent.
Yeah, I think he was totally projecting, 100% shallow, just exotic in a way. I think he was totally, I mean, he, you know, ENTJ, as he said.
Can you explain? Like, I don't really know what that means.
It's a personality type.
No, I know, but I'm saying, like, what is it? Can you translate it?
Extroverted, intuitive thinking and judging. Natural leaders who are decisive, confident, and charismatic. That's the AI overview from Google.
What are you?
I don't do personality tests, but podcast at nytimes.com. Let me and John know what our personality types are.
Yeah, actually, that's good. I would actually like to, yes, can you send emails? Let us know what we are. And then maybe one day we'll take a test and we'll see who's right.
I do think he was correct that she is smarter probably than she gets credit for on a daily basis. And I want to, at least my closing thought is, I will never forget the pasta moment was great, but when she walked into Nick's bedroom in his parents' house,
at his parents' house,
looked at the bookshelf and said, "Oh my God, have you read all those books?" And I paused it and I counted the books in the shot. there were 14 books. there were 14 books. They were 1,000% assigned in high school. Which he sort of alluded to. There was a Salman Rushdie book in the mix, which was the most impressive, if you want to call it that.
Maybe Ramsa snuck in and snuck that in the bookshelf.
Dragon Keeper, Ice Fire, Stone Fox. I'm just reading off some of these titles. There was a Divergent.
What are there these
was
books?
There was a Divergent book. And then there was Sophocles and Rushdie. I just, like, it was one of the greatest things I've ever seen in my life. Have you read all of those books?
Hannah, should you ever see the bookshelf by, you know.
Right.
I've read it more than Nick, I guess.
But I think she was just impressed that he had any books at all, given the kind of guy that he was.
American Romance. All right, we're going to go out with a note of Drake in honor of Nick to protect. Like, I know, like, look, in each of these couples, I think there's an instinct to, like, be skeptical of one person and protect the other person. You seem to wish to protect Hannah. Nick, for all his flaws, I wish to protect Nick. So let's go out with a little bit of Drake. We will be back with Karen talking about Survivor 47. And I'm trying to hit the A, but don't hit me up in WID me, baby. Send a boy a PIC to see me, baby.
It's Estead Herndon, host of The Run-Up from The New York Times. For over a year, we've been traveling the country.
We're talking to people in Wisconsin today about how they're feeling about the election. We're talking to people in Michigan specifically because it matters so much.
We are in New Hampshire.
Talking to voters about the issues that matter most to them. Listen to The Run-Up wherever you get your podcasts.
My communications person tells me that people actually listen to your podcast. Is this true?
It is, thank goodness.
We are back for part two of the reality television counter programming episode of Popcast. We are joined, you know her, you love her. It's Karen Gans. Gans Corr is on the show. Karen, welcome to Popcast. It's been a minute.
Thank you, John. Yes, it's good to be back.
Yeah, it's good. It's good to have you back. A thing that we all have in common, that we all share, and we've talked about on some occasions previously, is our continued commitment to the Survivor franchise. And I do want to say, when we all got involved with Survivor earlier in our lives, I do think it was better. And I feel like it's been an interesting few. it's been an interesting few years, and we've been interesting few seasons, I should say, that we've been riding out. So in the current,
I think lots of ups and downs throughout. I mean, it's not like it's not pure, like it started at the top.
Correct.
And it's a straight line down to season 47.
But I feel like we're in a bit of a dip the last three seasons.
Like, yeah, the new era is struggling.
So we're in season 47. We're about halfway through. We've all been texting about this among ourselves. Certainly the thing that has been the most gratifying to me about this season is that they finally got Rome out. And Rome, this is about 2 weeks ago, Rome was sort of a classic, I think, new style Survivor player, like very much fancying himself a strategic wizard, real talky, thought that he was, to echo something from the earlier part of this episode, a real high level thinker. He really thought he was doing the do. And in the episode in which he was summarily bounced, I literally was sitting on the edge of my couch in genuine fear that they were setting us up, that he had actually, in fact, outfoxed everybody else.
Right.
Thankfully, that did not happen. What a relief. But I do think it's emblematic of the lull that we've been experiencing in the last couple seasons, which is we are in generations of players who have grown up watching every single episode of every single season of Survivor. They know who got eliminated on episode 7 of season 9. They are, candidly, not that good at other stuff. They're mostly good at knowing about Survivor. Can we talk a little bit about where we sit in the bigger picture in the meta Survivor conversation right now?
To what you just said, I kind of wish they would do a season that was like all virgins.
Yes,
like
exactly.
Like people who had never seen it before.
It should all, they should cast only people who have never seen Survivor, and that would reset everything.
Yeah.
I totally
agree.
Like
lie detector test.
Like, seriously.
Who won season 10? I don't know. Okay. Then you can join the cast.
Although I do feel like they have dipped in and out over the last couple seasons of the new era in trying people who are not super fans, who are not crazy strategists based on the history of the show. And I think there are like bits and pieces of that on this season and in the last few seasons. Like, I think we disagreed about this last year, but John and I were very compelled by Q. And Karen was, I think, epically annoyed by
ready
Q.
To toss
But
I do feel like Q was not there to recreate games that he'd seen on Paramount Plus. You know what I mean?
No, but unfortunately, Q was there to recreate like his college football winning season.
And I do think that even elements of Rome's game were a throwback to like chaos agents of the past. Like he wanted to be a Survivor nerd strategist,
yes.
But he also had some like Brandon Hance in him. You know what I mean? Like some just total, like I'm so unself-aware. I have no idea what everyone thinks of me. And I'm turning the game upside down because I'm not playing it correctly. I do think something that's carried through this season is that people seem really upset and offended
when
having
voted
been
out.
Voted out in ways that I just don't think are valid at all. Like if you're thinking of like Tiana in this most recent episode.
It's bonkers.
I agree with this. Yep.
Also, Tiana, how did she not know she was getting voted out given that she was sitting in on her stump while every other person had gotten up and was negotiating around her, and she just was sitting on her stump?
I mean, Annika, the same way. I'm like, girl, nobody, you are not a main character of this game. Nobody was thinking of you as anything except somebody to vote out. like, and she was acting like her heart had been ripped out of her chest. Yeah.
But they do think they're main characters. They do think they're main characters. And also, I do think, was it last season or the season before where there were like blindsides like 8 weeks in a row?
It was last season because it was all the people that went home with the idols in their pocket, like 10 straight.
Yes. Right. So I think, and I don't know if this season's cast has seen that season. I'm not entirely sure.
They did refer back to it where they said,
I
won't go home like those people in the last season, basically. Okay. Right.
So, but I think it like got in everybody's head because they're looking at last season. They're like, everybody's a genius strategist. I am on this show. Ipso facto, I am a genius strategist. And I do think the tears genuinely come from the revelation that they are not the people that they thought they were, especially in a Survivor setup where, you know, forgive the phraseology, but it's not jocks versus nerds. Mm-hmm. It's not a bunch of people who can do all the physical challenges versus a bunch of people who talk about the people who do the physical challenges. It's not that. It's 95% people who talk. And bizarrely, John, what's my guy's name?
John Lovett.
Yeah. John Lovett just acts out. It's like everybody like saw themselves in him and were like, nope, got to get him out of there. Like, absolutely not.
Yeah. I mean, this season having a podcast host, like a quite well-known one, John Lovett, former Obama speechwriter and founer of Pod Save America. Rome, who we have referred to as an esports commentator.
He's like a Twitch streamer or something?
As an esports commentator. I did not do the research.
There's a radio host as well.
Yeah, Gabe with the big curly hair. He's a radio host. And then Sam, the young hotshot, is a sports reporter.
Teeny's a freelance writer.
Yes. Yeah. There are a lot of media types there. I mean, and this goes back to...
Has Teeny pitched you, Karen?
Not yet. Looking for Teeny's LinkedIn.
We have been pitched.
I'm finna Google that right now.
We've been pitched a lot of Ben Katzman, second runner up from previous season, who has a band or two. But the overarching thing that I've been complaining about in the new era and continue to complain about is the millennial Gen Z tech media type person, which, yes, is the demographic that is newly obsessed with Survivor post season, say, 40 or even post COVID. But that doesn't mean only those people need to be on the show. And I do think I've gotten like a bit of a breath of fresh air from someone like Sue, who's a bit older and owned a flight school, which she's keeping secret from people, but is cool. Kyle, the construction worker, you know, going back, which like nods back to like, you know, James the gravedigger from the golden years. You know, it's like, we really need way more of those people and way fewer people who we might have mutual friends with on Facebook.
I do want, just as a quick aside, Teeny graduated from Rutgers, New Brunswick in 2022. With deep respect, I don't know what the state of Teeny's freelance writing career is. With deep respect, like former recent graduate freelancer,
right,
who's made it all the way to here.
I would say, Joe, I agree with what you're saying, but you have forgotten one of my favorite characters of the past few years, who was also a bit of a media person, who was Aubrey.
Right. But Aubrey, I feel like Aubrey is from a previous generation where the Survivor nerd was a new archetype, like the
last of that.
Yeah. Our man, the small nerd guy who writes for TV, who won, you know who I'm talking about. I'm blanking.
It's like his last name, right? It's like Clarkson or.
Yeah. Survivor something. Winner. TV writer.
He's like a hero. How do you not know his name?
We're blanking. Cochran.
Yes.
Like Cochran was very much like, that was novel. The idea that Cochran could not only like be really good at the game, but win as the Survivor nerd. You know, was he the one who had like written his whatever, like thesis on strategy law
school,
and Survivor?
Law school paper or something.
Yeah, and obviously a bunch of Survivor contestants have since become professional Survivor commentators and podcasters.
Yeah, like
and
someone
whatever.
Else like, hosts a Survivor podcast, like in addition to who we've mentioned already, doesn't someone host like an amateur Survivor podcast? I can't remember, but it was one of the people.
Or whatever. Yes. There was way too... See, it's too much. It's not that that archetype can't work. It's just that it can't be the whole show.
Okay, so I have a thought, which is obviously post-Cochran, a number of people who maybe previously would not have applied to be on Survivor are like, oh, maybe this is a lane for me. Maybe I could do this. Do you think, hand in hand with that, people who are more physical threats see season after season after season of basically making it through the first two or three challenges to like help the initial tribe and then getting whacked either right before the merge or right at the merge and people saying, I probably can't win. Do you think that all that's in play? So it's not simply it's an over index of people applying who are strategic nerds as much as it is the game has fundamentally been remade, not as a physical threat game.
I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with Kyle on this season because Kyle has played a pretty low profile game so far, but since the merge has revealed himself to be a real challenge beast.
He doesn't look
like a jock, but he is like a blue collar salt of the earth guy. And he's like, washing them, you know, out on the field. So like, we'll yeah. I wonder if they'll see him as a threat or if they'll be too distracted by the sort of the strategists.
And but another issue is that in the new era, idol hunting has become almost as important as having a social game. So there are some people who don't even bother really having a social game and they just spend the whole time. So it's like, it's that third category. It's like a physical threat, like a brainy social player, and then like the person who's just going to keep finding them. I hate what the game has done with the idols and the
I was going to say, what do you think of that? Where it's like, you don't actually find an idol anymore. What you do is you find a piece of paper wrapped in another piece of paper wrapped in some string hiding up in the tree, and then you got to go dig something out. And what do you make of that?
They're not even giving these people rice anymore and they won't let them find an idol. It just seems like particularly cruel. Do you know what I mean?
But is that a reaction to the fact that idol finding became too obvious of a move? Basically.
Yeah.
And but like hide them better. I don't know.
Right. I do think they've sort of, I will say, in defense of the new era, I think they've been working stuff out as they go. And I think they've self-corrected on a lot of it. I think they've sort of, you know, that we were doing a lot of prisoner's dilemma stuff over like the previous five seasons, you know, like you lose your vote, you don't lose your vote, you know, all this high level thinking and a lot of chance, which is my least favorite thing in Survivor. Like, I thought they pulled it off on this most recent episode where they split the tribes.
I think that was Saul. Well,
no, but just the idea where like there are a lot of things that even if you're good, you can still get eliminated. Like there's just these moments of total deus ex machina. And I think they've cut down on that. And I think they've improved the changes to the idol stuff, the changes to the merge, the game itself, I think is like finding a medium. I mean, they just need to get rid of shot in the dark. We got one good moment when Caleb rolled a snake eyes or whatever, you know.
Free my guy. Yo, free my guy.
Like, that was awesome. Like, that's the peak. It's like, shot in the dark was bad before that and it's bad after, and like they just need to get rid of it because it creates too many contingency plans, I think, for tribal. But other than that, I'm coming around on where they've gone with the idols and the strategy of the game.
But when you say contingency plan for tribal, it reminds me that like for the first like 40 seasons, nobody ever renegotiated at tribal.
Right. A live tribal was had never been seen before until like, 10, 20 seasons ago.
I mean, it was exciting the first couple of times. Yeah, I find it baffling and destabilizing and I don't enjoy it.
I actually do enjoy it, and I do find it baffling that like people were bound in the first 30 seasons. They were like, nope, we have to sit on the stump. Like, we can't, like, I can't even look at the person next to me. And then at a certain point, someone was like, Jeff, is it okay if I get up? And Jeff was like,
that's one of the great things about the game, which is that it's very tightly made, but it's also very open. And you can break so many of the rules, but the game didn't get broken until like people only voted out who they liked for like many years, you know, or who they didn't like, who they voted based on who they liked and who they didn't like instead of strategy. Like the alliance didn't happen for many years, you know, like the fact that the game is like breakable and reinventable is to me why it's lasted almost 50 seasons, but to a point, you know, and I think that they reached a moment where the game had been broken so many times that like they didn't know where to turn. And like, to me, the answer is like, maybe take it back to basics, like make it really hard to survive again, have them out there a really long time. They shortened all the seasons. Like, I'm really looking forward. I think like 50 is obviously the make or break. Like, they haven't done returning players in a really long time. It's going to be that. You know, I don't know how far back they're going to go or if it's just going to be returning people from the new era. But like, to me, if you made that like a very classic game with lovable characters, like that could be a new era reset for them. And like, I think that's going to be sort of make or break.
Well, here's a question. It's almost impossible to picture the game without Probst at this point. Like, he's as much a character as anything else. But like, do you think it would benefit if he left? He'll never leave. It's just a hypothetical.
John, you had a thing last season where you thought he was over it and needed to go.
Was it last season or the season before? It was recently. There were two things that were happening. One, you remember where they taped like two or three seasons, like all back to back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like didn't, but aired them in normal rollout.
Right.
There was something going on there. I couldn't tell if it was like frustration fatigue of just like, I've been out here a long time. I couldn't tell if it was like, I absolutely hate these people. Like, I wish to not be around them.
I do think he's been really frustrated by some of the cast members over the last couple of years.
For sure. And then the third thing is there were episodes where I looked at him and again, it's like, no one here is a medical doctor, but he looked different, I thought.
That happens every couple of years.
He lives in LA.
Yeah, fair. But like, there was something where I thought he looked unwell for like a series of episodes and made me wonder, is it because he's aging? Is it because, God forbid, something's wrong? I mean, this is not a perfect example comparison, but it was like there were stretches with TJ Lavin on The Challenge where you're like, something's up with bro. Like, that's... And so I had that a couple years ago with Probst, and I was like, I wonder if something underlying, and they've obviously nothing, I could be totally wrong. Certainly nothing has ever been made public, but there did seem to be a combination of both physical and psychological fatigue in the same way that like new era Bachelor, just for whatever you think of Chris Harrison, it just doesn't hit in the same way. It's not like that particular blend of like charm and smarm, which was central to how the show is structured, like Probst certainty. I mean, that man is like a hosting superhero. He should win best host of a reality television show anytime someone gives that award.
Yeah.
But, you know, not getting any younger. But I do think if he gets replaced, it's unless they reset the show at the same time that they reset the host, I think it's unlikely to be a positive change.
Yeah. I don't think he'll ever leave.
I think he is the show. I don't think I'd want to watch it without him. I have a counterpoint, which is like, I think he's as good as he's ever been and still the best. And among the people in America, best at their jobs, you know, like full stop. Like, I just think like,
present company excluded.
Yeah. There's just like no, like he's so competent. I do think he still cares, which is weird. At the same time, like Karen, you watch Top Chef, right? Like I thought Kristen sliding in for Padma, I love, like one of the great, and I thought her exact sort of mix of iciness and warmth was crucial to the show, but I thought Kristen has like slid right in and I didn't even notice it. So, and maybe I'm wrong and I wouldn't miss Probst as much as I think I would.
Can I just make one note that irritates me every single episode? And Karen, as an editor, you will understand this.
I wonder if this is something that bothers me. Go ahead.
When he says, once again, immunity is back up for grabs, that is effing redundant. You cannot be like, once again, and back up for grabs. It's the same thing. Pick one. Immunity is back up for grabs. Or once again, immunity is up for grabs. Like, just pick one.
You're not wrong.
Where is the copy of
that drives me? That's not Karen's gripe.
Okay, my gripe dead is ass, every episode drives me nuts.
For 25 years?
Yes. Literally, I'm like, this will be the episode that he finally stops doing it.
Oh, no.
Anyway, if you're listening, stop doing that, please. Anyway, Karen, what's your
gripe? Two things that bothered me. I was bummed when he stopped saying, come on in, guys.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't find guys to be a gendered term.
Yeah.
And I was sad that they lost that.
Yeah.
And I cannot stand when they get to a challenge and he says, let's get it on. Stop saying that. Stop. Stop.
But I do like when he's like, this challenge is on. You know, like when
he does the voices,
the live voice, like he's like live, like I do like that. Okay. Of competitors this season, I think it's slim pickings, but if you're rooting for a person, who are you rooting for? And Karen, if it's the person that you said to me in text like 2 weeks ago, that is wrong.
Well, why don't we do a, will win prediction and a favorite wish they would win prediction.
I can't remember what I said to you.
Well, so you go first then, I'll tell you.
No, call me last because I got to think about it.
All right.
All right, Joe, will win, you want me to go? Win.
All right. Well, I want to run through the previous four winners because I do think it says something about where the show is. So we had Gabler in 43. To me, up top five worst Survivor winners of all time.
Yeah.
Even covering the dark years of like the late 20s or whatever it was.
Bizarre very strange, like kind of won it at the final tribal by pulling on heartstrings, but did not play a good game otherwise.
Especially because Jesse is one of the best players of the new era. He got voted out right before final tribal. I guarantee we'll see him back on 50 because I feel like he, you know, he was the one who had been in prison, a gang member, all that. He was, he's like, he's Survivor All-Star.
Hire us for the season 50.
He'll be back. All right. We had Yam Yam, pretty good winner, 44.
Love Yam Yam.
I think we all loved Yam Yam, but not as much as some of us loved. Yeah, I'm a Carolyn guy personally, but yeah, I mean, played a good game. D won 45.
No,
wasn't big on D.
Meh. Pass. Yeah, that was not a great bad selection. Season. Emily and Drew were in there. I liked them. They were good players, but yeah, D. And then last season was Kenzie, who Karen, you were pro Kenzie.
Very pro Kenzie.
Okay, so also with that set, I'm like, it's time for Sue to win Survivor. 47. Yes. I want Sue to win. I think like it's an older woman is often in the mix at the end, but very rarely seals the deal. Shout out to Tina, you know, all the way back in the day. So I would like Sue to carry it, but I kind of think it's going to be Rachel, the graphic designer, or I feel like Saul could win. I think Saul is very solid and playing a great game.
And now that Rome is out, yes. Like most obvious antagonist, because it was like pure antagonism those first like five episodes.
Yeah. And I think Gabe's playing too hard. I think Sam is playing too hard. I think Sierra's a non-factor. Teeny, I'm on the fence about. I gotta see how Teeny irons out the next couple episodes. John, where are you at?
Karen Gann's going next.
I can't remember who I said I hope to win.
Oh, I'll tell you. Wouldn't you?
I'm also going with Sue now. I think Sue deserves to win. I know I didn't say that, but I've changed my opinion.
Okay, Sue lying about her age has been phenomenal.
Also, Sue, I mean, I know that you're trapped on an island. You don't know anything about anybody. You believe whatever people tell or whatever. Sue being like, I'm however old, which is younger than me and like Karen. 45.
She says she's 44. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like respectfully. Respectfully. Like that anybody who accepts that at face value is absolutely.
There's amazing content of Tyson, former Survivor winner, asking his kids how old they think Sue is.
Oh no,
on Instagram. I recommend it if you haven't seen
it. I mean,
that.
But children can't judge what people in their 40s look like. These are adult humans. It's like unfathomable to me that they don't know what a woman in her 40s would look like.
I think they know and they're just keeping it moving.
Okay. Because like she probably could have said like 53. And pulled it off, but she went like for 20 years younger.
Wasn't Saul who looked at her in the eyes and said like, we look good for our age? Like saying that they were the same age.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, that was a great moment.
That was great.
But I agree with you on Sue for all the reasons you said. Also, like, she didn't do the best job of covering up that paint thing, but she...
It was so funny, though. See, like that was a gimmick that I enjoyed. I thought the paint move was really funny.
I did. I loved it. It looked like blood. They were like, Sue's missing. And there's like a giant pile of blood.
It's so difficult to clean up a bunch of paint that has fallen from the sky in the jungle without getting caught. Like, she did her best, but...
Yeah. No, she did. And like, I just appreciate her like general badassness and the fact that like, she's not playing too much with her heart. She seems like a very strategic player. And I mean, I kind of have a soft spot for Genevieve. Mm. We don't discuss her much, but I don't know. I think she's wily.
Yeah.
I like Kyle. Of all the physical players, he's my favorite. Not much of a strategist, but just seems like a nice guy I'd be happy to hang around with.
We haven't talked about Andy, the AI guy, at all.
Andy, I want to murder with my bare hands.
Okay, but this is, we somehow got this far into the conversation without talking about the new Survivor archetype is not a jock. It's not a nerd. It's a person who quite literally cannot handle being on Survivor.
Yeah, it's somebody with like anxiety. An emotional meltdown.
It's someone who's been kidnapped. Like it's like someone who thinks this is Squid Game.
I did say millennial Gen Z. I thought that covered over anxious.
it is striking to watch, like whether it's Banu last season, an absolute nadir of Survivor contestants, or Andy, who obviously now thinks of himself as a strategic genius and doesn't realize he's just getting, well, until last week, doesn't realize he's getting strung along by everybody. But like, I know there are medical screenings, psych screenings. Like, I know that there are all kinds of screenings. I am simply suggesting that they are screening for things, not screening things out.
That's you forgot about Jelinski from last year, the one who made it even less honestly, far
Jelinski,
than Manu.
On this season, Jelinski's a top five player. On this season.
But Ben, last season, they all spent sleepless nights holding his hand and getting him through panic attacks.
Oh my God, that's right. Go home. Literally go home. You don't have to be here.
We are in the anxiety era of Survivor, certainly.
It's miserable. It's genuinely miserable.
Yeah.
All right, Karen, the person you told me you were most excited about was Teeny, which was absolutely
I like Teeny. I don't think Teeny's gonna win, but like I like watching her play.
Go visit her in her hometown of Manahawkin, New Jersey. You guys go hang out. Okay. So here's the thing. Early in the season, I felt exactly as you guys felt about Sue. I was like, Sue's a sleeper. Sue is going to get through the first, you know, probably get to the merge. No one's going to take her that seriously. Gabe was kind of like, oh, I'm looking to form a bond with an older woman. What kind of weird hinge app approach is this though?
I'm defending Gabe. Young man, old woman, older woman. It always works. It's a great two-person.
But I wouldn't say it like that though. It just really sounded weird.
He really said it in a sketch way.
And that would be my strategy going on Survivor.
Great. So. If there are any people who are 42 who would like to partner with Joe on a future season of Survivor, just know that that's possible. My early thing was like, Sue's going to get through the first 5-6 weeks, going to make it to the merge, and then going to start chopping necks. She has not chopped the neck.
Right.
There, so if anything, the smaller the game has gotten, I actually think the more fraught she's gotten. So I don't know if there's like a second wave. On the plus side, no one seems to be gunning for her, but I don't see the like proactive, apart from the paint cleanup thing.
Well, she may still have an idol though, right? I think she still has an idol.
I think she hasn't played it yet. Yeah.
Right.
So, okay. So here's who I think is going to win. Caroline's going to win. I think Caroline's going to win because I think she is like Genevieve, but less abrasive. To me, Caroline and Genevieve are the two genuinely most dangerous players here. They're true strategic thinkers. They're willing to form alliances with unexpected people. And I think that they're both way, way, way sharper than they're actually letting on in a kind of like day-to-day what we're seeing in terms of how they communicate. So I believe Caroline or Genevieve, but most likely Caroline.
That type has come up a lot over the last couple of years because she's like Emily, the investment analyst.
Yes.
You know, exactly. From 45 or like Franny.
Yeah. Came into her own and like
Franny from 44. Like they have, and you know, there's a long line of analytical women who power through Survivor, but I think she's going to be seen as a strategic threat. And I don't know that she has a lot of personal deep relationships.
Caroline, you're saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, I just don't know that there's anybody smart enough to get 5 votes against her at this particular point, or anybody who feels like they need to gather 5 votes against her. And by the time I think they think they need the votes, I think it's going to be too deep into the season. Who I would be happy if they won, unfortunately, has already been voted out. And that was Keyshawn. Keyshawn seemed from a distance like new anxiety Survivor, but actually was like, I'm going to literally take an ice pick and shove it in your stomach Survivor. And I really obviously started feeling himself, was like, I'm playing a heavy hand, did like one or two too many conversations and got by Genevieve, who is one of the better strategic players. But in my, what I would have liked to have seen, what would have made me happy is if he had like pulled it back 20%, somehow gotten to the merge and then just done the thing that Roan thought he was doing, which is literally stir every pot and then walk away and laugh.
Yeah, they were really smart to wipe him out early.
They really, the thing is, they didn't see him at all. And then they saw it in like bright Technicolor, like on one day. And then there was like that with this guy. But that's who I would have liked to have seen make it all the way. But I think I'm going to go with Caroline to win.
All right, so we'll come back and do at least a short segment for the ending of the season.
Important final question.
Yeah.
Which of the three of us would go furthest on the show?
Have we not done this on podcast before?
We've done it over text.
Okay. So I'm a Survivor fan who has zero idea of wanting to play. I don't think I would deal well with the comfort. Same. I think I could do the physical aspect. I think I could do the strategic aspect. I have no interest in surviving.
Same.
So I have just, I just think like the bug bites and the scabs is just like, that's
you'd be a, like, a deal. You'd be a deal like Banu and Andy and you'd just be like,
yeah, I just, I don't think I could go far because of discomfort.
The obvious answer is, I think
it's Karen. It's Karen. Obviously
it's like
Karen.
Obviously no, Karen. Yeah, yeah. It's like literally, it's so obvious. I can't believe you're asking the question.
Yeah.
The only answer to that question is you.
I think most likely to get voted out first is John.
100%. I thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah. I think you and John love it. You know?
Yeah.
You and John love it.
You and John love it. We're doing a spinoff. We're doing a spinoff pod first out.
You first be the guy out. In the ocean being like, you heard my podcast or no?
I would just kill to hear what people say. Can I give you a podcast sticker?
I'd be putting podcast stickers up all over Fiji.
This is a beautiful place
to end this conversation. All the testimonials would be like, John keeps talking about this podcast he's on. I don't want to hear about it anymore. No, I would almost pay just to hear what they would say about all of us. I could deal with the discomfort. Like, it's fine.
Yes,
I don't think I could deal. I think I would be bad at the challenges. I think when I was way younger, I was a physical threat. And no, I think
that
no longer.
But that would help your game. That's why That'd you would last good. Longer.
That is, makes if you a were, Kenzie. That makes if, you a yes. whatever team
they'd be
doing.
Like, she's like, drowning. Like, how is she helping the team?
Karen, the actual hardest thing for you would be able to look people in the eye and not let them know you were super annoyed by them.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You would be like Emily in the beginning of the season, where Emily would just like look at a person and be like, you're not that smart. I find you uncharismatic. You're not that smart and I don't want to be your ally. That would be Karen for like literally 30
days. I had that skill
days.
Years ago. Yeah. I've gotten old and jaded and now I just don't care anymore. But I used to be very good at pretending social
All right, Karen,
situations.
We've said this before, we'll get your tape ready soon. Because we also, John and I also believe wholeheartedly that not only could you go far, but you would 100% get cast.
Yeah, 100%. There's no doubt in my mind if we filled out your application without telling you, you'd 100% get cast.
God, my poor parents, if they had to watch me on this TV show.
Are you kidding? I think it's time for you to have a life change. I think it's time. I think we're going to do it.
That's what we're going to do right now, actually.
Offline. Yeah. Yeah, we're going to do it offline. All right. That's our show. Every episode of Popcast ever is at nytimes.com/popcast. Subscribe wherever you get your audio podcasts. And now that we are largely paywalled, I guess you should subscribe to NY Times Audio. That is $6 a month or $50 a year. And then you get the full back archive of all episodes of Popcast of the new era, the old era, the Probst era, all eras of Popcast.
Returning players, new players.
Definitely returning players. Also, shout out to two returning players who I hung out with in Columbus, Ohio over the weekend, Rob Harvilla and Hanif Abdurraqib. Shout out to everybody in Columbus. We will be back next week. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We're out. The tribe has spoken.
Once again, immunity is back up
insanity.
For grabs.
Insanity. Insanity. Is there not one copy editor on the staff of Survivor? It's been 47 seasons. You can figure out how to not say guys, but you can't figure out how to de-redundify the one sentence that's said on every single episode.
De-redundify.
Literally. That's fine. I'm allowed to neologize. That's what I do. I'm a writer. I'm allowed to neologize.